It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, more than 90% of the members of Congress identify as Christian, much more than the general population. We look at a new Pew study on religion in America and in Congress.
First, Republicans on the Hill are planning to make good on their promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But as they pursue that goal, there are questions about what would happen to people in states that didn't fully embrace Obamacare, states like Wisconsin.
Jason Stein is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been covering this topic. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, Jason, Wisconsin took a unique approach to coverage under the Affordable Care Act. How might that hurt the state?
Well, it's really unclear what will happen to Wisconsin. Most states either expanded their Medicaid rolls by taking expanded federal money under the Affordable Care Act, or they rejected that Medicaid expansion and the federal money and didn't add people. Wisconsin took the unusual step. We're really the only state that did this, of adding certain people on our Medicaid rolls, but doing it by using sort of the usual payment method of some state money as opposed to having the federal government pay the full cost.
And it's been a while, Jason, but why was that Wisconsin's choice?
You know, Governor Walker and the Republicans in the legislature said they did not want to do a full Medicaid expansion. So they added some people below the federal poverty line, the very poorest state residents, and moved some people that were slightly better off into the other part of Obamacare, the health care exchanges. And when they did that, they said that they were avoiding leaving the state on the hook for a large payment, large expense, if at some point the federal government removed funding for those new enrollees.
So what do we know about how that affected Wisconsin taxpayers?
Well, so far, up till now, Wisconsin has paid hundreds of millions of dollars more than it otherwise would have paid because we did not take that additional federal money. Now, one of the things the governor and lawmakers have said, Republican lawmakers, is that we're still better off because now that the Affordable Care Act is going to be repealed, we won't have to, you know, we don't have these additional people on our Medicaid rolls. You know, one of the questions, though, is what a repeal will do with states that did expand the rolls. And one thing that the governor and some healthcare executives in the state are now saying is that they want to make sure that the Republican Congress and President-elect Trump don't make permanent the additional money that Medicaid expansion states are getting to the detriment of non-expansion states like Wisconsin.
So in an ideal scenario, what kind of outcome would Wisconsin hope would happen if the Affordable Care Act is repealed?
It's a really good question. I mean, one thing that the head of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, Eric Borgerding, has said is that, you know, right now under the Affordable Care Act, states needed to do the full Medicaid expansion to get this additional federal money to cover these new enrollees. Wisconsin did not get that money because we did only a partial expansion. He is arguing that you know, we should still get credit in terms of getting that additional money for the people that we did add. And that would be something that, you know, certainly some healthcare industry execs and the governor hope that Congress will consider moving forward.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now, state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about concerns from legislators and health executives about how repealing the Affordable Care Act could affect Wisconsin. And Jason, Wisconsin seems to hold a lot of power in Washington right now between Paul Ryan and Reince Priebus. Could that maybe influence how things turn out?
It certainly could. I mean, obviously we have the Speaker of the House, we have the Chief of Staff to the President-elect, as well as Governor Walker is the Chairman of the Republican Governors Association. So all of them have the ability to sort of make a case to their colleagues in the rest of the country for better fair treatment for non-expansion states like Wisconsin. What, one of the challenges that we do have, though, is as a state, is that we elected to do something that is really somewhat different than any other state. So I think the challenge will be for state policymakers is to make sure that we aren't left holding the bag, so to speak, or just not fitting in with whatever solutions are proposed or whatever replacement is proposed for Obamacare.
Is it likely that there could be pushback from other states that did take the Medicaid expansion money and did use it fully? Would there be resistance there to Wisconsin getting more federal dollars?
I think absolutely, in the sense that right now Republicans are not talking about adding new revenue streams for the healthcare overhaul. I mean, in many cases, they're talking about repealing certain taxes that were passed as part of the Affordable Care Act. So it does not appear that there would be more money available for this to, say, give money to states like Wisconsin while keeping other states, expansion states like California and New York, whole. And, there were some Republican states like Ohio and New Jersey with Republican governors that expanded their Medicaid rolls. And so, one of the things that might have to happen would be money being taken away from those states to help states like Wisconsin. And obviously, that could get politically tricky really fast.
Now, this is something, not taking the Medicaid expansion money was something that really raised the ire of Democrats in Wisconsin. We heard it years later about what if and if only. What are Democrats saying now?
Right. I mean, this was a source of repeated complaints from Democrats who argued that we should take this money because our state budget would be better in the short term, and we would also be covering more people. And Republicans and Governor Walker again repeatedly saying, well, it might be worse for us in the long term, and we're not going to do it. Now, Democrats are, they are not necessarily wanting to see the state in a worse position than other states. At the same time, they continue to be upset that the governor went this route, and to argue that if we have some risk going forward, that the governor and Republican lawmakers have some responsibility.
Do we know whether Governor Walker has spoken at all with President-elect Donald Trump to voice his concerns?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, certainly the governor has written to the president-elect and has requested that, certain things be done in the Medicaid program. He did not include this particular concern in his letter. But, he's made clear to me and, I think to others that this is a priority for him. And again, because he is, longtime a friend and colleague of both Reince Priebus and the Speaker of the House, I don't think he'll have any trouble getting that viewpoint across to Republicans on the Hill and in the White House.
And, Jason, as we wrap up, just briefly, what happens next?
Well, that's a terrific question, and one that I'm reading constantly, trying to pin down. In some form or fashion, there's going to be repeal of many elements of the Affordable Care Act and replacement with many other provisions. But how that's going to happen, what the timetable is, what the approach is going to be, is still fluid. I mean, we're seeing Republicans, I think, to a certain extent, debating one another about whether they should quickly repeal the law and then focus on a replacement, or try and do both those things at the same time, which would
be
more time-consuming.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
This is Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel.
Right now, for several decades, members of Congress have been predominantly Christian. In fact, 91% Christian in the most recent tally.
But that's at odds with trends in the U.S. population as a whole, which is much more diverse in its religious beliefs. The group seeing the largest growth is those with no religious affiliation, also called the nuns.
Greg Smith joins us now. He's been crunching these numbers. He's Associate Director of Research for the Pew Research Center and works on their domestic religion research, including their Faith on the Hill reporting. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is kind of a tale of two populations, who's in Congress and the rest of us. And let's compare and contrast. First of all, break down the religious affiliation of Congress for us.
Well, the religious affiliation of Congress is quite interesting. The number one thing to point out is that the big majority of members of the new Congress are self-identified Christians. In fact, 91% of all members of Congress, the new Congress, describe themselves as Protestants or Catholics or Mormons or other kinds of Christians. The remaining 10%, 9% or so of people in Congress identify with other faiths, the largest of which is Judaism, but there are also Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus and one Unitarian Universalist in Congress. The group that's really underrepresented in Congress, at least relative to their share of the general population, are people who say they have no religion. There's just one person in Congress who says they have no religious affiliation at all. Just 0.2% of members of Congress say they have no religion. Compared to the general public, where 23% say they have no religion, and that's a big, notable disparity.
Right, and that's been a big historical trend, a change in the United States and the population as a whole, right? People have been talking about the rise of the nuns, people who, it doesn't mean they're atheists necessarily, but they don't have a religious affiliation.
That's exactly right. If you look back over time at trends in religion among the U.S. population as a whole, what you see is that over the last few decades, the share of Americans who identify themselves as Christians, especially the share who identify as Protestants, that number has been coming down. Over the same period, ever since the early 1990s or so, the share of Americans who describe themselves as atheists, agnostics, or as just nothing in particular when it comes to religion, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, that group has been growing very dramatically. In our latest data, almost a quarter of all adults in the United States say they have no religion. That trend isn't evident at all in Congress. In Congress, in the new Congress, 91% describe themselves as Christians. That's virtually unchanged since the early 1960s, which is the earliest point for which we have data. And there's just one person in Congress, just 0.2%, that describes themselves as religiously unaffiliated.
Right. Did I see a number in the early 1960s? It was 95% Christians in Congress versus 91% now. Not a big move in the needle there.
Almost no movement of the needle at all. That's right. In the early 60s, 95% of members of Congress described themselves as Christians. That number has bounced around a little bit between about 90% and 95% in the intervening decades, but the trend line is really a picture of stability.
There is some movement in what kinds of Christians in terms of denomination. What kind of changes have we seen there when it comes to Congress?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Even though the share of people in Congress who are Christian has been quite stable, there have been some important changes in the relative proportion of people from different kinds of Christian groups. Most notably, the share of Protestants in Congress, the share of members of Congress who identify themselves as Protestants, has been coming down, while the share of people in Congress who are Catholics has been going up. In fact, in the early 1960s, about three-quarters of everyone in Congress was Protestant, and only about 1 in 5 were Catholic. In the new Congress, 56% describe themselves as Protestants, and almost a third, 31%, identify themselves as Catholics.
We're talking to Greg Smith from the Pew Research Center, looking at faith in the American population as it compares to Congress. And Greg, let's get a little bit into why this is. In other surveys, you've looked at voters' attitudes toward a lot of different factors for politicians. One very striking one in past research is people really don't seem to want to elect people who don't have a faith, who are religiously unaffiliated.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, these findings about the religious composition of Congress raise the obvious question. If the religious nuns are growing in the population as a whole, then why isn't their representation, why aren't religious nuns growing in Congress? And the data can't say for sure, we can't prove it's this or that, but we do know from other surveys we've conducted among the public that many people tell us that they want to vote for elected officials who are themselves religious. About 6 in 10 Americans this year, in 2016, about 6 in 10 Americans said that it was important to them for the president to have strong religious beliefs. And similarly, in 2014, we found that about 6 in 10 Americans said they thought it was important for members of Congress to have strong religious beliefs. So people say they want to vote for religious candidates. At the same time, the share of Americans also tell us that they are much less likely to vote for a non-believer for elected office if given the choice. They really say they prefer to vote for religious candidates.
Does it matter if that candidate happens to be the same religion, same denomination even, as they are?
Well, that can make a difference. We know, for example, that that people tell us that they'd be more comfortable voting for a Christian or even a Jewish candidate than they might be to vote for a Muslim or perhaps even a Mormon candidate. So that can make a difference. But there's also something to be said for just being a believer at all.
As long as you believe in something.
That's exactly right. Believing in something seems to count for a lot.
And then we have Donald Trump getting elected this year, and you've had past surveys where people rated Republican primary candidates on how religious people thought they were. Donald Trump appears to have scored very low, and yet a lot of people of faith ended up clearly voting for him. I don't know if you've been able to sort this out yet, because this is still pretty fresh stuff in a lot of ways. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what it tells me is that you really can't overstate the power of opposition in American politics. You're absolutely right. When we asked Republican voters back early in 2016 about whether or not they thought the leading Republican candidates were religious or not so religious, lots of Republicans said they didn't think Donald Trump was particularly religious, but they said they thought that he could make a good or a great president anyway. And part of the reason for that is there was their deep opposition to Hillary Clinton. Even if they had reservations about Donald Trump's own religious backgrounds and other kinds of reservations, they told us that if it came down to a choice between Donald Trump, a Republican, and Hillary Clinton, the Democrat, that they would support Donald Trump. And that turns out to be exactly what happened.
Now, with this whole mismatch between, as you say, just under 1 in 4 people being none, religiously unaffiliated, versus only 1 people in all of Congress having that same designation. What's happening there? I can think, you know, there are religions that are distributed in particular geographic areas. So you might expect, you know, representation here, but not there. Is it that the unaffiliated people are spread around the country so much there's not a pocket of them that is electing people? Or maybe that the nuns aren't looking for a similar candidate? I don't know. There's a lot of possibilities there.
There's a lot of possibilities, and it's hard to, you know, differentiate how much is due to this and how much is due to that. I would point to a couple things, though. One is that keep in mind that one of the factors that's driven the growth of the religious nuns in the general public is generational replacement. That is to say, religious nuns are much more numerous among young adults than they are among older people. And, of course, we also know that younger adults turn out to vote at lower rates, and they might also seek elective office at lower rates compared to those who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So it could be that as millennials get older and perhaps begin to vote at higher rates and perhaps to begin to seek elective office on their own, that some of these patterns might change. I can't predict that. I can't say for sure that it's going to happen, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on.
Is it also that the religiously unaffiliated category actually has a lot of variety, and with it, one person might be a hardcore Richard Dawkins quoting atheist, another might be somebody who considers themselves spiritual but doesn't like organized religion, another might be loosely Christian but not attached to a formal church, so maybe they don't have a commonality of interests?
You are absolutely right that there's a lot of diversity among the religious nuns. It does include people who do not believe in God at all. It includes other people who are unsure, agnostics, who are unsure whether or not God exists. And the largest group of religious nuns are people who describe their religion as just nothing in particular. They're not necessarily hostile toward religion. They don't necessarily have anything against it. They're just not particularly involved in any religious organization. So that's a diverse group. However, it's also worth pointing out that the same thing is true for people from all kinds of religious background. When we talk about Catholics, that's a big, broad group that includes people who attend Mass every week and maybe go to confession every month and are very committed in their practice of the Catholic faith, and others who identify as Catholic by virtue of the way they were raised or their family background, and maybe they go to church on Christmas and Easter, but beyond that aren't particularly involved. So that diversity of opinion, of experience, of commitment is common not just among the nuns, but among all kinds of religious groups.
So big picture, we have, according to the data, Christians overrepresented as compared to the population as a whole in Congress. The unaffiliated, the nuns, underrepresented compared to the population as a whole. I know you don't really place value judgments on the research you collect, but what do you make of this gap?
Well, you know, a lot of people ask and have asked what impact the religious identity of members of Congress, what impact does that have on the way they vote? Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard question to answer. You know, we don't have data. We have these data on the religious identity of members of Congress, but we don't have data on their religious beliefs, on their religious practices. We don't have data on how much they say their religion does or doesn't influence the way they vote. I think maybe one thing to keep in mind is that one important factor in determining how people vote in Congress is their partisanship, their party identity. And what we see there is that Christians constitute the big majority in both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses on Capitol Hill. And so that makes it really tough to disentangle just how much religion might drive the way that people vote as opposed to their partisanship.
We'll leave it there for now. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and I enjoyed it.
Greg Smith is Associate Director of Research for the Pew Research Center and works on their domestic religion work, including their Faith on the Hill reporting. He's with us to talk about data that shows that members of Congress identify as Christian at a much higher rate than the U.S. public as a whole. It is time for Food Friday. When you want to whip up a quick and easy dinner that's filling and something your family will actually eat, you're likely to find yourself reaching for that package of chicken. Americans are eating more chicken than ever these days, but it can be easy to get into a rut making the same chicken recipe again and again.
Our next guest is here to help us solve that problem with a wide variety of chicken recipes for those busy weeknights as well as those special occasions. She also shares advice for cooking the perfect bird as well as how to bring out new and exciting flavors to ensure you never get bored with chicken dishes again.
Cynthia Graubart joins us now. She's a food writer and James Beard Award-winning cookbook author. Her new book is Chicken, A Savor of the South Cookbook. Cynthia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, when I think of versatile foods, I think of something like a potato. But looking through your cookbook, you can do a lot more than I thought with chicken. What makes it so versatile?
It's really a blank slate. You can do so much with it. You can cook chicken so many different ways, easy on the stovetop, under the broiler, on the grill, in the oven. So you can use almost any technique with it. And you apply some spices or some herbs, some wine. Who knows? You've got a whole different dish every single night of the week.
And Cynthia, it sounds like you have a gut level connection to chicken, fried chicken, chicken dinners, because of memories you had when you were eating chicken as a kid in the South. What was that like?
Well, one of the things that was so much fun about writing this book was that I got to go down memory lane a little bit and talk right about how I relate to chicken. And one of the best memories I have, my grandmother could really fry chicken. She was excellent at frying chicken. And I guess I just sort of, it was a given that she was so good at it, and I loved it so much. But I had this memory of us going out to eat for chicken, for fried chicken, and I thought, why on earth would we have done that? And I remember it so vividly, and it was just hot as blazes in Jacksonville, Florida, and we were at Beach Road Chicken Dinners, which is just a little shack of a place, and standing outside waiting to get in. And when I think back on that time, why on earth were we waiting in line for fried chicken in the middle of the summer? Well, now I remember exactly why, and that is my grandmother didn't have air conditioning. So it was, she had declared it too hot to fry chicken, but she wanted some. So we went to the second best place in Jacksonville to eat fried chicken. One of my favorite memories.
Now, getting to cooking chicken, I cook chicken a lot, and usually I buy, chicken breast, chicken thighs, sometimes drumsticks. I'm still a little intimidated by doing something with the whole chicken, and that's a lot of what your recipes are. Make the case that I should give it a shot.
Well, number one, it's the easiest thing to do is to pop a bird in the oven. You know, no fuss, no muss. You just season it on the inside and on the outside and pop it in a hot oven, and you go on about your business while the chicken cooks. And the next thing you know, you have a glorious dinner waiting for you. So in terms of ease, dealing with the whole chicken is the easiest thing. You definitely want to season it. Now, if you're going to make the perfect roast chicken, you want to take a little bit of butter and slip it underneath the skin, but on top of the breast meat, and that helps tenderize, keep that breast meat moist and flavorful. And I like to turn the chicken on its side, on each side for a few minutes right at the beginning of cooking time, so that the sides of the chicken and more of the skin get cooked that way, and then finish cooking it right side up. So it's really easy to do, and it stays nice and moist.
Are there special herbs or seasonings that you recommend? I know you mentioned Lawry's as a favorite when you were growing up, but what are some other options?
Well, the world is your oyster in this case, because chicken takes so well to so many flavors in all the different world cuisines. I myself, I tend to just go with some lemon and some rosemary for my basic roast chicken. But then you can also season the skin beyond salt and pepper with some curry powder, or go into the marinades and make a mustard curry paste to rub on the chicken to marinate in it. So you can do a whole lot with a lot of the different seasonings and bring out a whole new set of flavors.
People talk about brining more and more lately. Are you a fan of that, and how do we do it, if so?
Big fan of brining. It's the insurance policy to make sure that you're going to have a tender bird. So brining is just a saltwater solution, and you soak the chicken in the salt water solution. A couple of hours is really all it needs, and then you rinse and dry the bird before you continue cooking it. And it technically, the science behind it is that the salt, the word is denature. It denatures the protein, which literally it unwinds the protein strands, so that it tenderizes, the meat is more tender. So that it's a really good thing to do, and I'm partial to a buttermilk brine. Now, that's really uptown, if you're asking me. So if you're going to fry chicken, soak it in a brine of salted buttermilk, and now you have got a seriously delicious piece of fried chicken.
We're talking with Cynthia Grauber right now for Food Friday, and she's the author of the book Chicken, A Savor of the South Cookbook. And Cynthia, you know how there's that joke about things tasting like chicken? Everything just kind of tastes like chicken. Do you agree with that? Is it sort of a blank slate until you add the flavors to it?
Well, I do. The American consumer is really starting to explore other avenues for purchasing chicken. So they're looking at heritage breeds. They're looking at purchasing chickens from small farms, their local farmers, the free-range chickens, and now they're starting to discover that chicken actually has a flavor, and that is so exciting. I'm really glad to see that trend, and I'm really glad that people are experimenting and, of course, supporting their local farmers who are in this endeavor. And it's great to really taste what chicken tastes like. It's actually not bland. if it's fed a proper diet and gets a little exercise in the yard.
Let's get into a couple of the recipes you shared with us. We have these on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way. This one sounds great to warm us up during a Wisconsin January. Summertime, anytime, bourbon peach chicken thighs. The name has sold me on this. Talk us through this one, Cynthia.
Well, this is a really easy weeknight recipe, and you want to take a skillet and brown those chicken thighs. I'm really partial to chicken thighs. I think
me too.
That's where you have just so much more flavor, and the meat is naturally tender, and you've got some extra vitamins in the dark meat that you don't have in the light meat. So I think they're nutrition packed and so much more flavorful. So you're going to brown the chicken thighs in a skillet. And you're going to cook them with some peaches. Now, I call it summertime anytime because you can use frozen sliced peaches. And I love, in the middle of a dreary winter, opening up my freezer and grabbing a bag of freshly frozen sliced peaches to add to a dish. It just brightens everybody's day to have a little peach in the winter time. And of course you finish the dish with a little bit of bourbon and yum. It is really a good recipe.
The bourbon goes on the chicken or do I have it on the side there?
Okay.
Or both.
You know how it is. Some for the cook and some for the dish, right?
It's Food Friday. We are talking about chicken, how to prep it, cook it, and make it fun. Cynthia Graubart is our guest. She's the author of the new book, Chicken, A Savor the South Cookbook.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like making chicken dishes? What are your go-to chicken recipes? Do you have a signature dish that you like to prepare when you make chicken? And what questions do you have? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Food Friday, and we're talking with Cynthia Graubart, the author of Chicken, A Savor the South Cookbook.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite way to cook or eat chicken? Do you have a favorite way, a secret, a tip on a fried chicken, oven-roasted chicken, a poached crock pot, you name it? And do you have a question, maybe some help for cooking chicken this weekend or for a special occasion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post and find a couple of recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
Cynthia, let's talk about the other recipe that you shared with us. It's biscuit-topped chicken pot pies, which sounds just about perfect. I love everything in that title there. So tell us about how that one comes together.
So this is also a really easy weeknight dish. So if you've roasted a chicken for dinner, you've got a little bit left over. You're going to use that extra chicken, chop it up, and you're going to put it in a skillet. You're going to saute some mushrooms and some, I call for cut green beans. So I am not a pea gal. I prefer to have the green beans, but I know that that's not traditional. So everyone can do as they wish, but I give you permission to make it without the traditional peas if you're like me. And some green beans, and you saute that and add some chicken stock, you thicken that up a little bit, and that's going to go in a ramekin. Then you're going to mix up a little biscuit dough, and this is just two ingredients. It's self-rising flour and heavy whipping cream, and it's just a super easy dough that you pat out and cut out some biscuit tops that fit right onto those ramekins and bake that in the oven, and you have a superb warm winter's night dish.
Ramekin, define for me, please. I think I know, but I'm not 100%.
No problem. A ramekin is a small bowl that can go in the oven. Usually okay. It's straight-sided. So it maybe you have French onion soup bowls or something small, little casserole bowls. Something that can go in the oven is the bottom line there.
Full points for honesty, Rob.
Yeah, I don't know everything. Even I admit that.
All right, let's take a caller now. Jake is with us in Oshkosh. Jake, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I just had a chicken recipe that my wife and I found recently. You just take a couple pounds of chicken breast and throw them in the crock pot with a full jar of salsa verde. And I like the jalapeno salsa verde. And you put it in there for about 4 hours and let it marinate and then shred it up. And it's phenomenal on tacos or chips or just by itself.
You're basically describing one of these staple foods in my household, Jake. Chicken, crock pot, salsa, shred. That's it. But it's so easy.
Ah, so that's the secret. Do you have something like that in the cookbook, Cynthia?
I tell you what, I'm coming to his house for dinner. That sounds wonderful.
And simple,
it's so,
yeah.
It's so versatile, too. So you've got this really flavorful shredded chicken, and I'm sure you use it a number of different ways, but that really is going to give you tasty chicken that's not dried out, and that's wonderful. I love it.
Hey, let me ask you, Cynthia, one that I don't think I see in your cookbook, but one I'm curious about, and you've cooked a lot of kinds of chicken paprikash. Any ideas there? The sort of Hungarian, Eastern European? Oh, it is. I missed it.
It is in there. And a dear friend of mine actually lived with a wonderful Hungarian woman who shared this recipe with her and then subsequently was shared with me. And it's such a, you know, it's so great to have this dish. Again, when I think of these stewed chicken dishes, you know, naturally I'm thinking of the colder weather, and chicken paprikash is definitely one of those dishes. And you use the Hungarian sweet paprika for it, and that's where the dish gets its fantastic flavor. Of course, plenty of onions go along with that and chicken broth, and it is a solid dish.
Yeah, it sounds good. I've never had it, but it's one of those iconic chicken dishes that I hear about, but I've never actually had myself.
Yeah. It's a good one. It's a good one.
Okay, let's go back to our callers now. We have Zach on the line in Superior. Zach, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Zach. I have been raising chickens, free-range chickens, for a while now, for 5 years here. And what I'm finding is that some chickens, actually, I seem to think, have better flavoring than others. And one of my favorites is the Jersey Giant. They're a real big chicken. Some of them weigh like 18 pounds. And they take a little longer preparation. You know, you have to soak them in the brine for a little longer. But they're really good chickens compared to like some of the other ones.
Zach, thanks for that. So that's an interesting question. Different breeds of chicken having different flavors, and he likes Jersey Giants. What about that, Cynthia?
Well, it's absolutely true. And the more you get to know your local farmer who's raising chickens, the more you're going to know about the different breeds and the ones that you really like the taste of. Now, I must say, I'm a little astounded by an 18-pound chicken. And I'm curious about what age that chicken would be. But definitely, you heard about the brining. The brining is the insurance that you're going to get a tender bird.
Zach, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Tony in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hi. We do a curry chicken, and ours is kind of a cheat. We buy this package called Golden Curry, and it comes in like a little brick form. It almost looks like a chocolate bar. Mm-hmm. And you just cut up the chicken. You follow the instructions on the package where you boil the chicken. You fry the chicken in a little bit of butter. Chunked chicken, I should say. You cut up the chicken breast, and then you fry it in butter, a little bit of butter, and then boil it in water. And then once the water comes to a boil, you add the curry. And once that's come to a simmer, you add, you've got steamed vegetables that you put on top of it, and then you put it all over rice. And it's like super good.
That sounds great, Tony. And I'm all for cheating. A long time ago, I used to try to guess at curry seasonings. I made stuff that was edible, but that's kind of my highest praise for it. Pre-made curry pastes for people who don't know what they're doing like me. That's not so terrible, is it, Cynthia?
I tell you, I am all about the cheat. I'm all about getting us to the dinner table to enjoy time together at the table and eating something that we're really enjoying. And if that is an already made curry, no problem.
Tony, thanks a lot. And let's go to Helen in Manitowoc next. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I have the same recipe that we're talking about. I use sometimes instead of chicken breast, in the crock pot. I use the boneless, skinless chicken thighs, which has great flavor. And you can even put them in. Okay, half a cup of brown rice in the bottom of the crock pot. Then you put the chicken. I even put it in frozen sometimes. It, you know, you can put the whole, just throw it in there. And then on top of that, two cans of drained and rinsed black beans or pinto beans or whatever you like. And let that go in the crock pot. By the time you get done, you've got the flavored rice with the chicken broth because it, as it cooks, it flavors it. It's just amazing, and it's quick.
Well, so you
in the crock pot for however long you need it.
You get all the components in one crock pot. That's pretty handy there. And that's, what do you think about that one, Cynthia?
Well, I am all about the crock pot at slow cookers. In fact, I've written two books about them. So of my many books that I've authored, I've got two about slow cooking. And I think it's just an incredible convenience that also gives you tremendous flavor in your food, and for relatively little fuss. And that recipe sounds delicious.
Thanks a lot for the call, Helen. We're talking to Cynthia Graubart about cooking with chicken. Her new book is called Chicken. And Cynthia, we've had a lot of, I think, quick and easy, either crock pot or quick weeknight recipes. How about you want to wow somebody, a special occasion or something like that? What's your go-to serious, awesome chicken dinner for an occasion?
Oh, there's just there's so many to choose from. I think actually mastering the perfect roast chicken is really something worthwhile, because what you really, you want that great skin that starts to get crispy on the outside, but yet you've got that tender chicken meat on the inside. You know, that really can be quite a lovely thing to serve for company. I've got a curry-based recipe called Country Captain in the book, and that is actually a dish known in the South, and that is a really nice dish to prepare for company, because you can make it early in the day and or even the day before, and have those flavors meld, so it's an easy dish for entertaining. And there's red bell peppers and onions and garlic and a teeny bit of cayenne and curry powder and Italian plum tomatoes. And then it's either a cut-up chicken or chicken thighs. You could even do chicken breast. Then you're going to cook all of that together, and you serve toppings, either some currants or raisins, a little bit of thyme and parsley, and you serve it over rice. Oh, also some almonds on the top are really lovely. And it's just such a flavorful dish. People really feel like you've gone to a lot of trouble, because there's just a lot of taste there. And you haven't worked too hard, and it's really a tasty dish for company.
And Cynthia, as we get ready to wrap up here, we haven't gone too deep in how to make that iconic dish we started with, fried chicken. What's the secret to great fried chicken?
Great fried chicken really begins with the brining stage, because you want to preserve all that moisture in that chicken. And you need hot fat. You want to protect the chicken with a coating of seasoned flour. I flour twice. So I flour the chicken, and then I dip it in an egg wash, and then I flour it again, because I really like that crispy, crunchy outside. And you want to fry it at about 350 to 365 degrees for that oil. And you monitor, and you don't overcrowd the pan. If there's one tip I can give everyone out there, don't fry too much chicken in the pan at one time. You're going to need to do it in batches, because once that oil temperature drops down low, then you're going to end up with soggy, oily fried chicken.
We'll leave it with that tip. Cynthia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy. Thank you.
That's Cynthia Graubart, her new book is Chicken, a Savor the South cookbook. You can find a couple of the recipes we've talked about, including bourbon peach chicken thighs, on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can also share your chicken cooking secrets and tips, again, on the Central Time Facebook page. The Packers play the Dallas Cowboys this Sunday, not on the frozen tundra, Lambeau Field, but down in Dallas. It's been a crazy playoff run for the team that a lot of people were writing off earlier in the season. After a rough start, the Packers ran the table, as Aaron Rodgers predicted. They won their division and won a home game in the first round of the playoffs.
Okay, so that's the good news. The bad news, wide receiver Jordy Nelson is not going to be playing. He's got a rib injury.
Dallas is being picked as the likely winner, about a 5-point favorite last I looked. All in all, I will be pleasantly surprised if the Packers pull this off. I always want to see the Packers win, of course. I virtually always want to see, sorry, Cowboys fans listening, I always want to see the Cowboys lose, so I'm doubly motivated here. But it's an away game. It's going to be tough. I don't know.
That's exactly the kind of attitude, Rob, that's going to hold the Packers back, that's going to stop them from winning. Everyone knows the fans bring about the wins. If they're in a good mental state, the Packers win. If they're being Debbie Downers, they're going to lose.
Well, I've got other superstitions than that. I will try to send positive vibes.
Good.
And we were talking earlier about a good snack food. You did some cheesy fondue for a fancy party, and we were thinking, you know, cheddar cheese. You said...
Oh, right, with a swirl of pesto.
Green and gold. All right.
Totally.
So make that, bring it over to my, you just drop it off at my house, ring, leave it on the porch. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.